I'm receiving on our nightcap as to the outcome of some of the other racers in the race. We did have a very, very wonderful race this year with no mishaps along the way, except the usual propellers being driven through the rocks and sand, and also a little bit of motor trouble here and there, but nothing happened along the river to make it nothing else, to make it anything else but a wonderful race. And a sleeper came in to take first place, boat number two, Fred Pitcher, the driver there, Francis O'Connor and Paul Newcomer, the members of the crew. It was sponsored by Pitcher Construction and Plywood Supply. And their time for the event all the way through was 21 hours, 8 minutes, and 17 seconds. We will give you the times as they pass their various checkpoints, the one at Tananoff and the one at Nenana, and finally right in here. And the second placer, of course, was boat number 11, who did the leading right on through, all through the race, up to the leaving of Cannonaw, where the gas up stop was. And that was where boat number 2 passed the boat number 11, was between Cannonaw and Nenana. And Harvey Strachan was the skipper of that crew, Don McVeigh and Gordon Strachan, other members of the Strachan boats. They were unsponsored, and their time for the event was 21 hours, 44 minutes, and 26 seconds, just about 36 minutes and 9 seconds to be exact, back from the lead boat came in over the line in that good time of 21 hours, 8 minutes, and 17 seconds, surpassing the 26 hours and some minutes of last year's time to create a new record for the Yukon Marathon. In third place was Marty Gray, as we look to another good time that was posted. Boat number 5, we were expecting boat number 13 in all the way along the line, and evidently Marty passed boat number 13, Alan Persinger's boat, along the way between Tananaw and Nenana, and came in very fine shape. 22 hours, 27 minutes, and 42 seconds was Marty's time, along with Bob Hager and Bill Berry, members of his crew. They were sponsored by the Mecca Bar and Bell Service Station. Also, not too far behind was Alan Persinger, and just a minute and 15 seconds difference in the times there for boat number 13 coming in behind boat number 5. Jack Harrop and Richard Persinger were members of Alan's crew. They, of course, were sponsored by the Persinger's Outboard Sales and Service. And in fourth place was the boat of let's see now, we don't want to get mixed up here in these times. That was Merrill Hanyan and Gerald Riley, and we find that they were the sponsors of their own boat, giving 5 good times all the way along through from that mighty Yukon race. Well, we'll give you more of the ideas of what went on in the Yukon 700 this year, 10:30 tonight, and also reminding you tomorrow evening, the time hasn't been specified as yet, we'll show the complete films of the Yukon 700.
Hughes, a little story about the Fairbanks, Alaska Fire Department in the last 20 years. I've been a volunteer fireman for over 18 years, and when I first came into Fairbanks, they had a Model T Ford with a brass radiator, an old model, and there were about 7 or 8 public-spirited citizens here had a volunteer fire department. There was a W.A. Wilbur and Jimmy Mulrooney and there was a fellow by the name of Buckley, United States Marshal here, that answered fire alarms for many years as a volunteer fireman. And there was another boy by the name of Jimmy Luce. And there was a fellow by the name of Oscar Bradley. There was a number of others. And at that particular time, there was a fire chief here by the name of Woodcox. And he resigned from the fire department to go to work for Chet Murphy's Coca-Cola bottling company here. And in the meantime, the city hired him, a fireman for a fire chief by the name of Huxley, Mr. Huxley. And he was here for about 2 or 3 years. There was only one or two paid men on the fire department from then on up for a few years. A little later, we had a couple of boys sleep in. And then as the years rolled by, we had a few more up until about 1957. We had, I believe, 9 men. And in the meantime, we had acquired a Seagrave truck and an old Studebaker. And during the war, the government furnished a civil defense fire truck for us. But when I started in the fire department, they had very little hose. There was only about 1,500 feet of hose, and all of it was old, very old. And for up till 1957, 58, we didn't have enough equipment to normally fight a fire. There were only two places to get water from. One was the NC, Northern Commercial Company's, standpipe at the powerhouse. And we had one other standpipe in the fire station with two taps on it. We could run out two and a half inch lines. And we had a tanker with a Waukesha engine on, they acquired. And we used to have about 300 feet of inch and a half hose on that. And that tanker would hold about 500-600 gallons of water. And we used to take that to the fires. That was in cold weather when they couldn't lay hose. Well, long about the middle of this 20-year time, along about 1950, we had a pretty bad fire down in the lower end of town. And we laid out all the hose they had. By the time we got it laid to the fire, the hose froze. It was about 25 below zero. And we went to use the hose at the other end of the line. There wasn't enough water run out to wet the ground. So that house, of course, burnt down. There's many buildings burnt down here from lack of equipment. So the public-spirited citizens here in Fairbanks took an interest in things, and we had two or three fairly bad disasters. We had the Allies Room, which was a restaurant and a bar, and it burned to the ground. And then we had the Pioneer Grill and the Northern Hotel. That burned to the ground. And the Pioneer Hotel burned after that. There was 5 people burned up in the Pioneer Hotel. And then we had a fire down on between 2nd and 3rd Avenue of the old Wachter's Meat Market and the Co-op Drug and the old Smith Gun Store, which had been purchased by a man by the name of Patton, and he was rebuilding it, and it burned to the ground. And a little after that, we had the Riverside Bar and Hotel. It was a semi-three-story building in there. It burnt practically to the ground. And there were several accidents over the years, but the only losses of life were in cabins around town for quite a while, and that was caused from smoking and drinking, and they'd lay down in bed with a cigarette, and the cabin would be an inferno before anybody discovered it. I answered many, many, many of those calls, and I've had as many as 6 and 7 calls in a single night. I would some nights be the only one at 40 below would show up there at 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and the town whistle blowing. So I used to be my job first to get all the volunteers out and get everything on its way. So I would call everybody I knew. And we had a distress whistle here. If we blew 6 short blasts, that means help. And generally some of the town would get up, because that was a pretty powerful whistle the NC company had that time. And everybody would get out and help, and the different restaurants around town would furnish hot coffee and sandwiches for the men while they worked, putting the fires out. And then along about 1948, we had a fire at the Northern Commercial Company telephone office, and they had a garage and tire shop there, and the fire got so hot that they lost the telephone here for about 3 months. And we have about 10 or 12 radio amateur operators around town, and they all set up their equipment to operate as an emergency telephone system. And of course, the Army communications system here had some phones, and they tied an ACS phone or an Army phone in to some of these mobile radio units and radio stations, and we had telephone that way. If somebody wanted to call, they'd have to go to somebody's house and use the radio. And they placed one in the hospital, one in the police station, one in the city hall, and one in the fire station, a number of strategic points around the area. And then a little later, during the war, or right after the war rather, they got a little interest in civil defense. And of course the military had furnished a lot of equipment at 4% to the municipalities to use for emergencies and for air raid warnings and signaling and communication. We built mobile outfit with 14 receivers and transmitters in it on wheels that we could tow around the country, and we had a number of individual mobile units. They finally put two or three of them in police cars, and then we had a couple in the fire trucks eventually. And now we have a fairly modern communication system, and we have a couple of hundred water taps all over town where the fire trucks can pull in and get water. There isn't too much area in Fairbanks that can't be reached within the city limits, can't be reached with the hose we have on hand. We carry now about 12,000 feet of hose, both 2.5 and inch and a half, which would be about normal. We have a 31-man fire department now with two brand new LaFrance trucks, complete with all equipment. We bought $23,000 worth of accessories and equipment for the trucks. We have gas masks and respirators, and we have an ambulance here that's fully equipped with stretchers. And these things we didn't have in the early days. The first ambulance that was furnished to the city here was bought by the tavern owners and the liquor dealers, and driven over the highway when the highway first opened, and it was wrecked in the course of bringing it up here, but it was repaired and salvaged, and for many years it ran around here lopsided. The frame had been bent, but we drove the ambulance. They were all volunteer drivers then, and they'd call citizens here to drive this ambulance. Then a little later, that ambulance got pretty bad, and another organization got together here and helped raise funds to get another ambulance. And then a little later, civil defense come along and the military and surplus some Cadillac ambulances. And the city of Fairbanks had two of those in succession, which got wrecked. They have one now that's been reconditioned and serviced. It's in pretty good shape. But there has been some very bad disasters in Fairbanks prior to the time I come here. But now we feel that we've got the city, per capita-wise, pretty well covered. Although there is about 3/4 of the people live outside the city of Fairbanks. There's only about 1/4 of the people, or 25% of them, live within the incorporated city limit of Fairbanks. And of course, people living inside and outside make demands for services and help. So now, if the local people outside the city will sign an agreement and organize a volunteer fire company that's available to reciprocate, the city will cooperate with the outside areas. Since becoming a state, there's a lot of planning and involvement and things going on in regard to incorporation and boroughs or districts, and they will have to be, it'll be several years before it's really ironed out. So that's about all I have to say about the Fairbanks Fire Department right now. I'm retired as far as the volunteer fire department's concerned, and they have a real good chief. His name is Mr. Jensen, and they have about 30 real good men. There's 8 or 10 men to a shift all the time. This year they have started to burning the grass in vacant lots and yards around people's homes where they're not able to do it themselves, which is as it should be. And we as volunteers did that every spring here. And we didn't get any pay for it at all, but these men are on the payroll, and the budget for the fire department of the city of Fairbanks runs about $350,000 a year now, and about $385,000 a year for the police department. So when we were on the fire department, the budget was very small. If we got $5,000 or $6,000 for the fire department, that was exceptional good. So you can see what a change has been in the last 10 to 20 years. I hope this little history of the Fairbanks Fire Department in the last 20 years will be of interest to someone in the future. This was Harry Hughes. I'm a member of Pioneers of Alaska, Igloo 4, and the Yukon Order of Pioneers of Dawson City, Yukon Territory. This is May the 31st, 1961, at Fairbanks, Alaska. July the 28th, 1961, and this is Harry Hughes with a little memorandum of a trip to an old-fashioned sluice box cleanup at a gold mine at the invitation of Mr. Robert Bloom, an old Alaskan pioneer, very well known here. I was permitted to take color-moving pictures of the cleanup, as well as 35 millimeter color for slides and prints. And at a later date, Mr. Bob Bloom will give us a tape recorded story of these pictures and this mine and this cleanup for our future records. This was a very interesting trip on my part. There was about 300 pounds of concentrate taken out of the boxes. There was first about 160 pounds of almost pure gold with the mercury used in the boxes to clean it up. And that was placed in metal containers about 6 by 6 by 12 with a lock on them. And they weighed in the neighborhood of 90 pounds when you had to handle each one, the two of those. And then there was several pails, white porcelain pails, of concentrate taken out and loaded, carried up and loaded on the truck and taken down to be amalgamated and boiled out and treated and weighed and assayed. And then there's a gentleman from the university, from the Department of Mines, took samples to make assays and to report on the scientific aspects of this particular endeavor. This ground had been mined three times in the early days. There was an enormous amount of wood and timber from tunnels of years gone by, and they use a cat and a drag line to do their stripping and getting ready, and then they use water to wash the gold and push it with the cat into the sluice box and hose it down with a hose, or a giant, they call it. And this was a very wonderful thing. When they first went to wash the gold down in the box, it was almost covered with pure gold, the first part of the box. At a later date, Mr. Bob Bloom will give us a tape recorded story on the history of this mine and this endeavor. This is Harry Hughes. July the 28th, 1961. Just a memorandum for the record.